Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out how a compound in yams has vasodilating and antioxidant properties that can make a big difference. This was published in the Journal of Medicinal Foods, and it was done at the Medicinal Plant Research Center in Brazil. That's one of about 15 studies I'm going to share with you today, always published in peer-reviewed journals, done at respected institutions, but for whatever reason, just doesn't seem to get into the mainstream media. Also today, a couple of commentaries. One commentary is about, is romantic love going extinct? This is in the current issue of Psychology Today. And I'm going to ask you to think about your response and then call in and we'll have a discussion. I'd like to hear your points of view. I'll hold off on mine. And when we do that segment, you'll call 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'll also be talking about how many different ways our government tries to manipulate us. I was thinking about this recently, and then last night I attended an event celebrating 25 years of a publication on health, and there were a lot of complementary physicians there and just different therapists. And as I was speaking, I was asking, what are your concerns today? And nobody talked about health, a pretty healthy group, but they were concerned about what's happening with the government and its different agencies, taking more and more of our rights away from us. So I came back and put together this, and then I saw that John Whitehead, one of America's finest constitutional attorneys, had written something also called Sin Taxes and Other Orwellian Methods of Compliance that Feed the Government's Greed. So I'll be combining my commentary I wrote this morning and John's, and then you'll have a chance to call in again and give us your talk back. Last evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I pulled back the curtain on something that no one seems to be willing to discuss, the so-called whistleblower that has been used as the excuse to indict Trump. Now, there are a lot of reasons that you would want to indict Trump, but I've never heard of a situation where a whistleblower was not allowed to be known, not allowed to testify, not allowed to have any of his information challenged. Normally, when a whistleblower comes forward, whether it's Edward Snowden or Mr. Drake or Benny, Chelsea Manning, they put forward their presentation. Why did they become a whistleblower? And the government or corporation or whoever is the person that they're challenging has an opportunity to, you know, cross-examine them, which is the way our court system normally works. Not in this case. So what I did last night is I had an in-depth discussion giving facts and names and dates and times of date of who attended meetings with the whistleblower, clearly and unequivocally showing that this was a setup by the Obama administration and those in the deep state, including the CIA, the State Department, and the White House. And this has Hillary Clinton's fingerprints all over it. So I would have hoped that the mainstream media, with all of its Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists at the New York Times, the Washington Post, would have brought this information forward. None have. We will today. Also, I want you to hear from, in his own words, Smedley Butler. It's a short 2-minute piece about what did he believe was the real mission for going into Panama and Cuba in the Philippines and South American countries. Well, he said that war is a racket, but it's different when you hear someone actually and see them. You can watch this. And I'm going to play that short clip. And also, I'm going to play a clip from Michael Douglas, the actor. He's talking about Unbreaking America, Divided We Fall. I found this interesting, but I'm only going to play half of it. I'm not going to get to the segment where they talk about solutions to what's wrong with our two-party system and how corrupt both parties are. Again, I'm going to ask you, listen to the segment, watch the segment. If you're on a computer, you can go to youtube.com/PRNFM. youtube.com/PRNFM. And then we're going to hear something that has not been discussed yet about how we've been lied to by the government, by the White House, the State Department, the defense and agencies, the Pentagon, about why we're in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history. But there's one person who tells us the truth. It's 46 seconds long. And we're going to play this. And wow, someone didn't do their homework here. We did. Again, you can call in each of these segments and share your points of view. We'd like to hear what you have to say. So we start with the latest on health and healing, always. And in this case, something that most Americans don't consume. That's yams. Now, yam and a sweet potato are considered one and the same. They're not. A sweet potato is generally an orangish color, and there are various varieties of sweet potatoes, but a yam tends to be not strongly colored. It's slightly more pale than a regular potato, like an Idaho potato, but it's very rich in nutrients. And wild yams join the roster for heart-healthy foods, according to the Medicinal Plants Research Center in Brazil. I would concur with that. There's a compound called diosgenin, D-I-O-S-G-E-N-I-N, and it's in the Dioscorea species of the yam. There are many different varieties of yam, and it has very strong vasodilating effects that can boost your cardiovascular health. This is a great preventative as a food. And how I prepare yams is that I will bake them. You can bake them at about 300 degrees, so it's not that hot. And never bake them till they're fully baked. And then you thinly slice them. And then you can saute them with garlic, onion. I like shallots. And then I like tarragon on it with a little Himalayan sea salt. Makes a delicious little side dish, much like eggplant, you know, just putting eggplant grilling, a thin slice. The key with the eggplant is the thinner the slice, the juicier it becomes, the quicker it cooks, the easier it is, and it holds its nutritional value. And I like to baste the eggplant with different seasonings, like you make a little reduction. You could take some raspberries and puree them, and then add in some mint, and then baste the eggplant with those two flavors, just with a basting brush, as you grill it on both sides, it creates an entirely exotic-tasting eggplant. In any case, yams are terrific for you. So if you have any heart condition, then consider consuming them, as you would a potato, but they're far more nourishing than a potato. From the University of California at San Diego comes a study about having found the meaning of life. The answer determines health and well-being. What do I mean? Over the last 30 years, according to the University of California, meaning in life has emerged as an important question in medical research, especially in the context of an aging population. A recent study by researchers at the University of California School of Medicine found that the presence of and the search for meaning in life are important for health and well-being. And this goes from young adults right through to people who are senior citizens. So many people, according to one of the lead researchers, find meaning in life, their purpose, let's say, and that forms a philosophical perspective. But meaning in life is associated with better health also, and wellness, and even longevity. And that's according to a Dr. Jesty, Senior Associate Dean for the Center for Healthy Aging and Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Neuroscience. This was published in the Peer Reviewed Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. Now, I share this with you because in the study that we're 3 weeks from completing, it's a 90-day study, 60 days on campus, which is done, and then 30 days at home. And I told all the recipients on four separate occasions, including participants before we started, during, and then at the completion, when you go home, you're on your own. And you won't be getting a call from me doing a you-ha-ha and let's all, you know, kumbaya. Because in the real world, you can go to a yoga retreat, you can go to taking cooking classes, even with America's Greatest Chef, David Boulay. I've seen a lot of people have taken his classes. You can take your yoga classes. You can attend different seminars that people have, and good information, these seminars, self-empowerment seminars around the country. You can take a retreat at a Buddhist academy and engage in silence, meditation, a very austere and spare diet. And then you go home, and the first time the phone rings, you're right back to the old behavior. The epigenetic has control. So in 53 lectures, 47 of those lectures that I did, and some of the lectures I do are long, it was all about understanding the purpose and meaning of your life, and no one can give you that. You have to come to that on your own. And one of our problems is that well-intentioned people, including parents and sometimes teachers, believe that because we're young and vulnerable, which we are, we therefore would best be guided by what their references on life's boundaries should be, so they keep us within boundaries. Now, sometimes that's a very good thing. It prevents us from acting out in ways that would be not just irresponsible, but dangerous. But on the other hand, sometimes those boundaries become immutable, codified with dogma and stigma and fear and insecurity by the parent. And then that's our limitation. Struggle as we will in life, we find that all we're doing every day is just going through very well-attended rituals. Have you ever gotten that where you woke up one day and just realized, my God, everything I'm doing every day is just the same? Where's the newness? Where there's a freshness? Can we do a restart all over again? And for most people, the answer is no. And that's why, once you understand which life energy you are, why certain people will stay in the bad neighborhood, even a neighborhood that is environmentally unsound, and they won't move. Other people, based upon their conditioning, the epigenetics of their life, will move. They'll even look forward to starting over in a new place. And so when a person goes home from an anti-aging clinical study, the only one I've ever done of its kind, that a whole lot of scientists are watching, by the way, we're interested in, will you succeed or fail without us interfering, without us encouraging, or without us exposing someone to anyone else's energy? That's the key. Let me explain this. When you go to work each day, you have to adapt to the energy of your workplace to survive. It becomes a work environment culture. And as a result, it's generally just not one person or two within a workspace, but it's the entire culture of the workspace is adapting to what the rules are in order to survive there, be rewarded, be given bonuses, promotions, or just accepted. If you go into a workplace and you decide you're going to change it because there are things that you feel are not good or healthy, you run the risk of being alienated from the very people that you're trying to help because they're going to say, hey, friend, you know, you're jeopardizing our job. And they have every right to say that. You, on the other hand, should think about what it will mean for other people who may not have your strength, may not have your willingness to put themselves at risk because they have financial responsibilities, and this job right now at that moment is the only thing that's paying the bills. So we have to think not just in the micro need of our own life, but the macro need of others around us. And all that becomes a part of the contemplative way that we live. And that's part of the meaning and purpose of our life. If your purpose is to be an activist, if your purpose is to be a contributor to the greater whole, you have to consider what other people think and feel about an issue, or remove yourself if you find it's too alienating, or you're just not going to blend to someone else's what you consider a suboptimal way of thinking and living in. It's like, for example, I have no right, and never exercise a right if I had it, to insist that those in my life be vegans. And by the way, less than 10 people my entire lifetime have ever been vegans. And that didn't mean that they were great relationships or friendships. The fact that you're vegan doesn't mean that you're a better person. It means that you've made choices, and your reason for making those choices are tied in to your unique being. Maybe you had a heart attack. Maybe you had cancer. Maybe someone you love died because they had diseases that could have been prevented. And you see this, or maybe because of the ethics of what it means to eat an animal. If you're against the abuse of animals, are you against the abuse of humans? Are you against the abuse of other humans of darker skin, like in Yemen? For all the feminists in America, and I support completely the principle of you should have the choice of what goes on in your body, I just hope you make a smart choice. Do you also have the same respect for people who are now victims of our hegemonic principles, our neoliberal principles? But if you're a good liberal and you're voting for a woman, then the assumption is that you're voting for people that you're going to be mirroring, or they mirror you. But what if that doesn't extend to the real world? Then what kind of hypocrisy are we living through? These are issues that we have to discuss, or should. So when they say here in this Journal of Clinical Psychiatry that published this article, an important article, that when you have an understanding of your purpose in life, who you are, you're going to be healthier in the majority of cases, because part of that is honoring your body. Interesting how many deep intellects are completely disconnected, like Nietzsche was. I thought he was a fool. Don't mistake a person's sense of, and I've read all this work, don't assume that because a person has a profundity in their intellectual capacity that somehow they're a really smart person. And we know how many best and brightest we've seen in our country just drive us right to hell off a cliff. The Vietnam War, the bailout of Wall Street, you know, the breaking of the unions, the promotion of pharmaceutical drugs as the best way of living through chemistry, pathologizing children, pathologizing pregnancy, pathologizing aging, the overdrugging of our children, a completely fraudulent mental health care system, mandatory vaccines. All of these are part and due because very best and brightest from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, top of the rung people are at the very bottom feeding intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. Don't conflate the two. Don't assume because someone's rich or famous that somehow they are a better person or should be deferred to. I don't defer to anyone ever. Not because I can't learn something. It's because the moment I abrogate my responsibility for being a critical thinker and what I want in my life and what I don't want in my life and what I want to accept and what I want to reject, then I start looking back and thinking, my God, the one thing I should have been rejecting a long time ago was common knowledge. And think of all the doctors who graduated top of their class and are selling chemotherapy to patients. And everyone thinks that's just terrific. And they have all the credentials to justify doing it and no common sense that all their patients are dying. We don't look at the results of our so-called best and brightest minds. We don't challenge them. We don't judge them by the same standards that we ourselves, considered less than, are judged. Boy, you don't realize how powerful it is when you give away your right of critical thinking. And right now, Americans are not engaged in critical thinking. So just keep that in mind. Because we just, right now, for the first time in American history, we have the largest generation ever, 81 million millennials, who have, the majority have, not a solid grounding in who they are, their meaning in life, and how to be completely responsible for their actions or challenge the actions of the people around them that are acting out in inappropriate ways. And that's why we have some of these problems. Over 80,000 cancer cases a year are linked to poor diets. Who says? Tufts University says. What's that mean? It means that about 5.2% of new cancer diagnoses could be directly attributed to poor diets and excess body weight worldwide, I'm talking about. But in the United States, it's much higher. Cancer could be prevented in about 95% of the cases. Well, this is from the National Cancer Institute's Cancer Spectrum. So if we have 80,110 new cancer cases, they had a suboptimal diet as an attributable cause, then those people who die from that, they found that 12,589 were obesity-mediated associations. So just being overweight caused 12,589 cases. Now, smoking, drinking, nutritional deficiencies could account for the other number, adding up to 80,000. But now just think of that for a moment. Step back and just ask yourself, who has the responsibility in our country of informing people of what causes disease? Well, the Surgeon General, U.S. Public Health Service, which is an umbrella organization under which comes the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, the CDC, the National Cancer Institute, the Food and Drug Administration. So all these agencies and all these hundreds of thousands of employees and tens of thousands of scientists and all these hundreds of billions of dollars that are put into this, you have yet to have a single person, not a single soul out of there, come forward and say, here's a list of what we know can cause disease, and we have a moral responsibility to help prevent that. Now, when was the last time someone came forward as an official person from any agency and told you, here are the 20 foods and beverages that can cause cancer, like high sugar fructose soft drinks or sodium nitrite from eating cooked foods, meats, heterocyclic amines, acrylamides from all those buns? No one. And you won't, not in your lifetime will you ever see that truth said. But they capture you on the other side, where when you finally are sick, they make sure that it is only they that you turn to for their therapies. How successful are they? Well, terrifically successful. I mean, the cancer establishment has got the gold standard on success. 20 million Americans have died by using only establishment therapies in the last 40 years. That's a terrific record. A failing, and yet they've been rewarded. Not a single person chastised, not a single person losing their license, not a single person having to give back the money, not a single medical school, not Sloan Kettering, not MD Anderson. So just remember what I just said. We know what causes disease. We know what causes cancer. We can prevent 95% of it. We're not preventing one single cancer. That's how bad it is. Also, from Worcester Polytech Institute comes a study about probiotics. And probiotic yeast can offer an effective treatment for drug-resistant fungal infections. That's important when you consider that candida is out of control in a lot of people's bodies when they have a high sugar intake. So this is good. So now they've got another thing along with garlic and ginger, onions, vitamin C, quercetin, wild oregano oil, all of those are good against candida. Remember, in immune-compromised patients, which is a lot of Americans, or even healthy individuals with implanted medical devices, candida can penetrate the submucosal tissue of the gastrointestinal tract and reach the internal organs, where it can cause life-threatening systemic infections. The microbes' drug resistance stems, in part, from their ability to adhere to surfaces and form biofilms. And the biofilm is a complex ecosystem that can become a physical barrier against drugs. And biofilms can form on medical devices like catheters and IV lines and even contact lenses that can then penetrate epithelial tissue in the body, leading to all kinds of infections, including deadly blood infections, Candida auris, A-U-R-I-S. So the first thing you do is you prevent it. Sugar, alcohol, wheat products, refined carbohydrates. First you prevent, and then second, the things I just suggested can make an enormous difference. And finally, from the University of Hohheim in Germany, energy drinks induce acute cardiovascular risks. They kill people. This is a randomized controlled trial. There were a lot of case reports suggesting a link between energy drinks and adverse events, including deaths. So the objective was examining cardiovascular metabolic effects of the energy drinks and mixtures and see what was the outcome. In this randomized crossover trial of 38 adults, they examined the administration of energy drinks and then looked at the risk factors that manifested, and the results were staggering. Yeah. You start drinking these energy drinks, which are drunk by millions of Americans every day, you run the risk of dying. Even a single one high-volume intake of an energy drink causes adverse changes in insulin sensitivity, in blood pressure, and that can lead to death. So, think again. We're 26 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to have you listen to Smedley Butler take on war. Then I want you to hear General David Petraeus of why we can't leave Afghanistan now. And mind you, this is just after news broke this week that the Pentagon, the White House, State Farm all have been lying about why we're still in Afghanistan. And maybe this will give you a better understanding, connecting what Smedley Butler says and connecting what General David Petraeus say. Those two back to back in just a moment.
Smedley Butler, a U.S. Marine Corps General Major who was the most decorated Marine at the time of his death, stated it well when he wrote,
I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies. In China, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best that he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. War is a racket. It always has been. A few profit and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it. You can end it by disarmament conferences. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the prophet out of war.
Okay, you heard what he said. You must take the prophet out of war. What are we doing? We're making war and the fight against terrorism the most profitable industries in the world, along with the pharmaceutical industry. And even the pharmaceutical industry is benefiting because all those soldiers that we send over there end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. Then they're given the medications, and then about 21 each day kill themselves. We're doing nothing to help those people because they're not important. Making the money for Halliburton and the other 26 major corporations. So then I was told, well, what we need is we need a woman to be in that position of power, because then they would see from the feminist perspective why war is such a has such deadly consequences. Then we took a look at who runs the five largest military industrial complex companies in the world. They're all women. So shouldn't we say it's not about women or men, but it's about power and the psychology of power and being a part of the culture of power? You obey the culture and you're rewarded. You challenge it, you're punished. Now let's hear what General David Petraeus says of why we can't leave Afghanistan.
If Afghanistan can become the Central Asian roundabout, to use President Karzai's term, to where it can be the new Silk Road, think of the implications for that. Recalling that, of course, Afghanistan is blessed with the presence of what are trillions, with an S on the end, trillions of dollars worth of minerals, if and only if you can get the extractive technology, the human capital operated, the lines of communication to enable you to get it out of the country and all the rest of that. Very big if, and of course there's a foundation of security that would be necessary on which to build all of that. But again, the prospects are very significant if you can achieve objectives.
Okay, well, one of the reasons we're staying in Afghanistan is to make sure that every opportunity to extract trillions of dollars in minerals are there, but there's no legitimate reason to be in Afghanistan under any circumstances. So this is the lie that's been told. Smedley Butler exposed the lie after 33 years as the most decorated, let's say, Marine up to that point. So that's something we should be considering. Now I'm going to go to a clip from Michael Douglas. It's a 10-minute clip. I'm only playing five. The first 5 minutes tells you the problem, and it's Democrat and Republicans equally. But then the solution, I'm not having him tell us. I'd like for you to tell us. I'd like for you to listen to this, then call in and share your points of view. What do you believe would be a good resolution? Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Here now is Michael Douglas.
America's political system has been hijacked to ensure those with power keep it. If you look at American politics and think everything is fine, this video is not for you. To the rest of us, things seem pretty broken. I mean, our forefathers created a beautiful system and we live in a magical country. How the hell did things get so bad? These days, just 2% of Americans trust that our elections work how they're supposed to. Congress has an approval rating of 20%. Our leaders are locked in partisan warfare and they aren't fixing anything. And we're angry. We're angry at the system, at each other. Our country is getting poorer, sicker, more divided, and our families are paying the price. We don't even talk to each other anymore. America's political system has been hijacked to ensure those with power keep it. And for the rest of us, well, it's not so good. I'm going to show you exactly how today's political system is creating the problem, exactly how we fix it, and how the solution ultimately depends on you. This Venn diagram shows the relationship between an elected official doing what the people want and their likelihood of getting reelected. Ideally, they'd serve the people and have a high likelihood of reelection. But a recent Harvard Business School report by Professor Michael Porter and Catherine Gale showed that the relationship looks more like this. They found virtually no correlation between serving the will of the people and getting reelected. In other words, if our elected leaders do their jobs, they're more likely to lose their jobs. How is that possible? The report blames it on two privately held gain-seeking organizations, America's two major political parties. In 2019, both major parties publicly threatened to blacklist candidates and contractors who veered from the party lines. They control the money, the debates, the primaries. They even draw their own voting districts. A full 61% of Americans want another option. But any third party or independent who runs is seen as a spoiler. So year after year, we choose between the lesser of two evils, Democrats, Republicans, Republicans, Democrats. In any other environment, a new competitor would swoop in to better serve their constituency. You hate your cable company? Here comes streaming. But the two parties have rigged the system to block competition. But it gets worse. In 86% of House races, we now know which party will win the general election before it even starts. That means all of the competition is in the primaries, where as few as 14% of voters participate. And primary voters tend to be more partisan than those who vote in the general election. So the most partisan candidates win the primary. They're virtually guaranteed to win the general, so you can guess what happens next. Over time, the parties move further and further apart. This graphic shows members of Congress who worked with the other party to pass a law in 1953. The gray lines represent their collaboration. The more lines you see, the more times they crossed party lines to pass a law. This is how it looked in 67. In 81. Look what happened in 1995, and by 2011, it represents where we are today. Hardliners are rewarded, collaboration is vilified. Congress is so gridlocked they can't even pass the most basic laws to improve the lives of everyday Americans. For the first time since the Great Depression, life expectancy in the U.S. is actually going down while it goes up in the rest of the world. We were once ranked top in the world for education. We've fallen to 27th. We can't afford life-saving prescriptions, and medical bills are forcing families into bankruptcy. Almost half of American families can't even afford basic necessities like rent and food. What I want to know is, how do we fix it?
All right. That particular video is, if you want to watch the whole thing, it's entitled Unbreaking America Divided, We Fall, and it's 10 minutes long. Now, what do you feel is the solution to this? That we have two parties, extremely polarized, highly contentious, both have made enormous poor judgment calls. We the people have suffered. We shouldn't have millions of Americans who are suffering the way we are, including children, over 16 million children going to bed hungry each day. But that's not anyone's talking points. And as a result, our needs, the planet's needs, are not being addressed. Now, I'm writing today, I've been writing for 4 days, a major commentary on the environment. It is, well, you'll hear it tomorrow. But it's important that we understand the truth, and the truth is not coming from either party. The truth is not coming from the media. The truth is not coming from the heads of industry. So we have to find a different place for our truth. But there's a solution. What is the solution? I have my solution I can share, but I'd rather hear yours. 888-874-4888. Now, when we have calls coming in, I'll be happy to take them. Now let's go to another issue that I raised, and this is from Psychology Today, and I'll quote it. It says, many millennials are avoiding serious relationships as they may involve love. Then it says the following, is romantic love going extinct? Perhaps so, given the evidence showing that many millennials are resisting entering into serious relationships because they may involve love. Considerable number of young women in particular are rejecting the idea and practice of love, thinking that falling under the spell of the emotion and of another person is a sign of weakness and vulnerability. The low marriage rate among millennials reflects this down-with-love attitude, something that presents major social and cultural implications for the future. What's behind millennials' evasion of love? Many simply do not want to take on the commitment and responsibility that comes with anything or anyone requiring a long-term investment. The generation is also shunning ownership of cars, homes, and full-time jobs, making their apathy towards or aversion to love wholly consistent with their freelance lifestyles. With many millennials up to their ears in college debt and the children of divorced parents, love is often perceived by members of that generation as a luxury they cannot afford or as a foolish enterprise on which to embark. The dodging of romantic love has actually been in the works for some time now, in much part because of the temporary madness that comes with having a big crush on someone else. Love is constant effort, one woman in her early 20s told a reporter for the Washington Post on Valentine's Day, with her friend chirping in, it's so annoying, and another saying, it's a waste of time. Love was impractical, it was silly, and a sign of vulnerability. These and many other women around their age across the country believed preferring flings and hookups to serious relationships in their romantic lives. Okay, you may agree or disagree. I'd like to hear your perspective on this. We have some callers on. Let's say hello to Darren from New York, the Bronx. Hi, Darren, your turn.
How you doing? Do you want me to address, the video clip or the statement you just had about the marriage?
Either one.
Okay. For the video clip, I think the solution definitely would be people to form a third party and not worry about, it seems to be too much worrying about public opinion. A lot of times, you know, well, someone says it'll be successful or not, and also attack it from all ends. If you could also, people who are independent like myself, join the Democratic Party in a sense and vote for what they would, you know, call fringe elements, maybe like, you know, they're not, but, you know, Bernie Sanders, Ocasio, people like that, who are actually going to try and do something, and, you know, might be able to change things, you know, as they are now. But other than that, if we wait for something to happen, nothing's going to happen. I think you say that a lot, and it's true. There's a great deal of apathy in the country. But, you know, thing is, people have to try something and not believe that someone's going to reward them immediately or say something good about their efforts. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate that, those insights. Let's say hello to Daryl from the Bronx. Two Daryls back to back. Hi, Daryl. Your turn.
Dr. Null, mental health, entrainment therapy, decreasing the fear in the population, it has to be comprehensive. And once people can see through this, can shed themselves of their fear or de-energize the fear, then they would be better able to follow a given plan for their lives. However, right now, what I see most people is terror and automation. They want to give away their autonomy. I mean, they want to give away their authority because they don't want responsibility because they're afraid of what that might bring.
Well said. Both salient points made, and I think you're making some very important comments on pieces of the puzzle that we have. There could be 1,000 different inputs, all correct. Both of yours are meaningful. Thank you very much, Daryl. Let's say hello to Bill from New Jersey. Hi, Bill. Your turn.
Hello, Gary. Thank you for what you share all the time. I was listening to what you were saying earlier about the wars, and there's always a war on drugs, a war on cancer, a war on something, and it, I think everybody must know it's all about money. They can't really think there's such a threat that we've been doing this for eternity. But I think it's all by design, a very primitive design. And also, one thing I never hear mentioned is population control when it comes to war. I think, you know, there's only so much space, and this globe we're on can only sustain so many people. I think this is a means of population control, and it's generally not the rich and famous that go off and fight and die. So that's all I wanted to share. Just make a comment on that.
Thank you, but hold on a moment. Let's address that issue, the last comment you made, and let's deconstruct your thought on this and see if we can expand on it, all right? There have been a lot of comments by Bill Gates. He actually went public about population control, and he is of the mindset of the founder of Planned Parenthood, and that's a part of the background that we never hear. Margaret Sanger, she was a rampant racist. She hated black people. And she was part of the eugenics movement. And by the way, the eugenics movement didn't start in Germany. It started in the United States and then was brought into Germany to justify, for example, in the mid-1930s, where all psychiatric patients were euthanized, were killed in gas chambers. And not the concentration camps, but actually in psychiatric facilities in the basements. And that was considered good because they considered these people feeble, and it was in the public interest not to allow these people to live because they had bad genes. Margaret Sanger and a man named, what was his name? Papineau? I'm not sure. He was the one who was financing a lot of this. Now jump forward to where we say, well, we have almost 8 billion people on the earth, and one argument is that we have too many people for the Earth's natural resources. The reality is that we could easily handle 10 million to 12 million people if those resources were fairly and equitably distributed. They're not. Then you have this other issue that in Africa, as just one example, or in the Amazon as another example, indigenous cultures have lived there virtually with no carbon footprint, no destruction to the environment, living in harmony, much like in Africa, the Bushmen of the Kalahari. You would never know the Bushmen of the Kalahari existed, yet there's a lot of them, and they live in perfect harmony. They even take ostrich shells, fill them with water, and then bury them over 3 feet deep and with an identifying stake in the ground, so the next person that they do not know who comes there will know a person thought enough about their survival that they didn't eat all the berries. They didn't eat all the different edibles. They left some. Now, that's, imagine having to learn ethics and empathy and cooperation for the common good from the Bushmen to the Kalahari when we can't get that out of Harvard University. And then you look at whose land is being confiscated for mono farming in Africa. Hundreds of thousands of acres that both hedge funds are buying. Bono is one of the spokespersons for this, not the brightest guy on the block, but certainly a wealthy guy, and we automatically conflate that if he's wealthy and he's famous and he's loved, good for his singing, fine. But don't then become the poster person for someone where you haven't a clue as to the later life consequences of confiscating people's land and having hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of native people, the indigenous population, thrown off the land so that you can grow a crop, wait for that crop to become in short supply, then flood the market so that you can capitalize on a maximum profit on a highly anticipated or needed commodity like food. So it's vulture capitalism at its worst. Then in the United States, we're losing farmers every day. They're closing up. And that's partly because they're holding to tradition. They're not looking at where farming is beneficial. They're looking at where farming is just an arduous process. Now, I'm a farmer. I'm a certified organic farmer. I taught the first organic farming classes in New York State's history, the Fertiller Farm. Many of you were up there. Thousands, about 15,000 of you over a 15-year period ventured up to Stone Ridge right above New Paltz, and learned every weekend about farming and soil conservation and the importance of bees and pollination and organic. In fact, I grew the first organic produce that was brought into New York City, up in Goshen. A group of us did. And it wasn't even acceptable. We had to stop because nobody would buy it. Couldn't even give it away. So I gave it away to people in church groups and people who came up on the weekends. They could take all they wanted back at the harvest. So you have to have an education program to intentionally impart new insights with people. So if I told you that the people who consume the most products and leave the largest carbon footprint are the very people who shame everyone else, the people who want your guns and don't want a wall, all have armed bodyguards and have walls. Is there a contradiction there? Yes. For those of us who are actually home, putting people who are homeless in homes, right now in my home, I have a homeless person. If you want, I'll get him on the air tomorrow. You can hear what it's like for him to have been homeless with no hope and people not wanting to give you a chance. Well, where is Michael Moore, who has seven homes? Where are all the other Hollywood celebrities who have homes all over the place who could put a person in? Again, properly screening them to make sure you don't get someone that can be violent or is mentally incompetent of being in that situation. But there are a lot of really normal people with healthy emotions who are out on their butts and no one's helping them. What does it say about a political system that both left and right refuse to address, refuse to it? When was Nancy Pelosi going to invite one of the people through her gated community into her multi-million-dollar estate? She's worth about $100 million. Surely she could afford to help some homeless people. Instead, she didn't have a problem with everyone being homeless on the streets of San Francisco, as de Blasio and others don't have a problem with people being homeless in New York. They're not seeking real solutions. The solutions are simple. Go to Occam's razor. Go right to the point. You know, convert 10 million square feet of unused public housing, government buildings, into livable spaces for singles and families and those with special needs, and put cafeterias in there with healthy food and healthy dietitians. I met a healthy dietitian last night. Worked in New York, but didn't last long because there wasn't an environment where people were interested in a healthy meal from a nurse, a dietitian in a hospital setting. The whole system was corrupted. They had institutional food. Well, our whole armed forces are corrupted. They only get garbage food, depleted uranium. So nobody's caring about the consequences of how we exploit something. So when Leonardo DiCaprio gets his smug little ass on a private jet to fly from the Cannes Film Festival to pick up an award for Environmentalist of the Year from the Riverkeepers and then flies back so that he can dine on Kobe beef, and use up more carbon and pollute the environment, and then goes to the Cannes and goes out on one of the largest yachts in the world, that's a big carbon polluter. But no one sees that because he gets some millions of dollars that he's passing through his foundation, as if like Greta Thunberg, who's going to be probably nominated for Goddess of the Year. And exactly what has she done outside of raise hell? Good. And got our attention? Good. And absolutely nothing, nothing, nothing coming from it. Not so good, but we focus upon the effort, not the results. So if we took all the rich people in the world and said, you know something, you've way overused your place on this planet. You shouldn't have any more children. You, the hedge fund, the equity partners, everyone on Wall Street, everyone in Washington, D.C., university professors. When was the last time you saw their worthless asses coming out of that gated community they live in and realizing they can actually say something without offending one of the millennials and do something good for the world? There's a sprinkling of them. When did they go on general strike to stop all student debt and have it all forgiven? When did the students go on strike? The very students willing to tell you what you're not allowed to say because it offends them and therefore they don't want you to have freedom of speech. But why don't they use that freedom of speech to say every single college and university student that's in debt should go on strike so we forgive it? We could. We did. According to Chris Hedges, $29 trillion, my figure was $21 trillion, that we gave to corporations that caused our problems, not a penny to the average person. I see, but there's no time for an average student to get away from identity politics or how they suffer or how they want a university to be a safe place. Universities should be anything but safe from speech. Universities should be a place where you can say what you need to say and other people can say why you're right or wrong. Because once you start abridging freedom of speech and censoring it, then you're going to demonize the people for saying anything. And then one day, there's no place for you to speak. So you see, when it comes to population control, I would absolutely be for population control if you controlled no more politicians having children, no more rich having anything. Yeah, that's the group that you have to look at because they're the ones causing all the problems. The industrialists called the Koch brothers. Man, should their parents have wore condoms, like 10 of them at a time, to make sure none of those got up. They probably came from anal breech birth anyhow, based upon what their character was like. So I would agree with you, but it's the wrong people that they're wanting to control, and the world's resources, if properly and appropriately and ethically and morally and humanistically shared, then we wouldn't have any starving people, nor would we have any place on earth that could not sustain life if we gave it the resources and the commitment that they deserve. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Thank you. I just have one other thought that population control, I was actually, what you said is true, I was referring to in war as casualties, death. Keep the population down by killing people, not only through war, but disease control sometimes.
I've never seen any truth to that from my perspective, but the truth of war is profit. The casualties of making that profit are indifference to those who suffer, the domestic people, the poorest, like in Yemen. When was the last time you heard an American politician say that they're going to go out on strike on the Capitol steps until the war in Yemen is addressed and our participation in this genocide? You won't. It won't happen. So that's the world we live in. That's why we need not just third parties, we need multiple parties, and we need to change the entire electoral system to take all money out of politics. You take the money out of politics, then you have allowed the average person who has ethics and the politicians who don't to compete. And I believe the American public would know which one to put in a position of power. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Jeremiah in Washington, D.C., David, and we'll get to you tomorrow. Nana up in Harlem, we'll get to you tomorrow. Call back in. Promise to get you on the air. By the way, good news. For all of you who ordered Curing the Incurable Cookbook a year ago and you haven't gotten a copy, they're coming tomorrow. And I need someone who has a van or a truck. There's lots of copies, and they're heavy. It's a big book. To come in and pick them up, because we have no place to store them, and we'd like to get them right over to BAI so they can get out. You see, the trouble is when we told the station stop playing the premium, they didn't. That wasn't by accident. And as a result, a lot of people thought they were going to get a premium and should have, if what I suggested, that for every premium that's called in, that money for the premium, the cost of the premium, is set aside in a separate bank account that management cannot touch, and get one of the honest members of the local station board to oversee that those premiums, no matter which producer it is paid for immediately, and therefore people get their premiums in a very quick way. That's easy to do, but not when the station wants just to make the money off a premium and then forget that it exists. We haven't forgotten, and that's why we helped them. We paid $12,500 out of our pocket to make sure you got the book. So it's here. Arrives tomorrow. Someone call 646-926-5422. That's 646-926-5422. Come by. Pick them up. Take them over to BAI, and BAI will have volunteers. We'll ship them right out to you. Everybody who ordered that book will get it now. For those of you who ordered the water filters a year ago, and you didn't get it because, once again, the station spent the money, I'm going to come up with some ideas for special fundraising just to get those premiums paid for and so you can get them. Now, I'll give you those ideas tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. Moon, blue, moon.